Celebration 25. 25 years of making new friends, of holding hands with Southern California. News, information, and entertainment. Join Celebration 25 with
Bill Jenkins.
And welcome in to our Saturday night. For the next 3 hours, it's open mind, and I am so delighted you're along. And I believe tonight may be one of those special nights we want to call a friend and get your tape recorders going. Because it's a night we're going to dedicate to something extremely serious that just very well may be a part of the reality that we are having to live with these days. The reality of the weather war. In the spring of 1983, it stopped raining in the Midwest. The United States lost about half of its all-important corn crop. In April of 1984, a column of water 150 miles wide, rose out of the Sea of Japan, 200 miles off Tokyo, south of the Kuril Islands, to an altitude of 60,000 feet in 2 minutes. Five Boeing 747s headed for Tokyo took evasive maneuvers, expecting to be hit by a shock wave caused by what they saw as a massive mushroom cloud suddenly appearing in front of them. There was no shock wave, no heat blast, no contamination. It was a cold explosion. To the trained observer and aware researcher, that event suddenly brought into focus puzzling ongoing sightings of pulsing plumes of smoke off Bennett's Island and Novaya Zelma to the west of Bennett's Island on the Soviet Arctic coast. December 1984, off the Southern California coast, the area was rocked for weeks by strange booms or explosions, window-rattling shocks which could not be explained. Within 48 hours after the boom stopped, Los Angeles was ripped by a violent killer windstorm, which then moved across Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, and up the Adirondack chain. Now, in the wake of that weather incident, there was record flooding, gripping ice storms, rain, and cold, which broke all known records. The East Coast plunged into a sub-zero deep freeze, which lasted for weeks, brought business and commerce to a near standstill. Also, nearly 500 Americans were killed in weather-related deaths. Mother Nature on a rampage? Or could these events be related? Well, for some dedicated men of science, these events and others are pieces of a giant puzzle. And with an open mind, they are putting that puzzle together. And I am very glad to have with us tonight one of those men that is putting those pieces of puzzle together. And he's a good friend of mine, a good friend of yours. He is very concerned about this problem, and we want to deal with it now. The weather war. Mr. Thomas Bearden. Tom, welcome aboard.
Thank you, Bill. It's nice to be back.
It's always good to have you. Is there an undeclared war going on between two superpowers, Tom, and one of them doesn't even know they're being attacked?
Well, I think there is, Bill. It's certainly my opinion that that's exactly the case. I think that for a period of some years, the Soviet Union has been using the new technology that it's developed based on Nikola Tesla's discoveries to manipulate the weather over North America. And I believe there's enough evidence for that to cause any open-minded researcher very serious concern indeed. Now, for example, the science that is emerging that's used for this. We'll take a small digression to cover just a bit of that. In fact, I want to take a little bit of an unusual digression from what I normally say in this fashion. I want to tell you first about some serious flaws that exist in the science we presently have in the West that allowed us to miss this particular thing that's used in the weather war. The first one is in, strangely enough, the very science that, mathematics that permeates most of our science called vector analysis. There's one of the assumptions at the heart of vector analysis, one of the axioms, that establishes what we call a zero vector. It makes all of them identical and makes all of them equal to zero. And it's standard practice in physics that when you have a vector or a sum of vectors, these particular entities that represent moving things, dynamic things, When you have a series of those that sum to zero, you simply throw away the series. It's based on that axiom. As a matter of fact, modern physics itself says that at base root, there's nothing static. Everything's dynamic. And that the vectors themselves are established and kept there by dynamic processes. That's the way quantum mechanics views the situation. So really, when we have such a system, we should keep the vectors there as still being present and hidden inside the zero. So one of the problems facing us is the fact that an axiom of the very mathematics we use contains a glitch, so to speak, that causes us to miss some of the things that happen. Okay, I'll pass through this very quickly, and I hope our listeners will bear with me for just a moment. We then pass to general relativity. When Einstein formed general relativity, at that time, which was well before World War II, way back there, we're talking back, you know, back 1918, along in there, when the heavy work was going on at the initiation of general relativity, really 12, 13, so forth. At that time, the only way they knew to bend and curve space-time, which is what general relativity deals with, was when you had a huge collection of mass, something like a sun or something like a giant star or a neutron star or a collapsing star. Certainly, where we would be with our instruments on the Earth or out in space or whatever measuring, no one knew any way to cause any serious curving or bending of space-time. In other words, we call that the local region. That's where the observer is, and that's where the instrument is that we're doing our measurements with. And so Einstein himself put in the assumption that you really wouldn't have general relativity where you yourself were and where the instrument was. Now, let me make this very clear. This is a standard assumption taught in all the universities throughout the land that in the local system where we're measuring and where we're doing our detecting, we do not have general relativity at all. And yet it's called general relativity. The general relativity occurs way out yonder somewhere, but it doesn't bother us where we are. We are very calm, cool, and collected. None of those effects are where we are. The reason that he did that was so that he could save the conservation laws. And all you energy buffs, perk up your ears, please. If you do not make that assumption, for example, suppose we really knew how to curve the space-time appreciably where we were. If we could do that, then all of the conservation laws go out the window. That is, the conservation of energy, conservation of mass and momentum and so forth, and even the conservation of charge. I want to repeat that so that everybody understands what I'm saying. We already know in general relativity, ordinary physics, that if we could bend the space-time locally, all of our conservation laws would go out the window. Now, that would be a very strange world indeed, because everything that seems stable and steady and permanent in our world and gives us a feeling of personal security that reality is going to continue to march on just like it always has, all of that would be changeable. It would be up for grabs and engineerable. And so, since nobody knew how to do that, Einstein put in the assumption that that would not happen. And so, the world remains safe and sane where the observer and the instruments are, and all the crazy stuff happens out there in the stars or in the black hole or someplace way out there from us. Now, I want to reiterate that I pointed out an effect here that if we could get it in our instruments or make devices that would do that, we would have devices which would do some very unusual things indeed. And that's already in the orthodox science, but assumed away because we simply said we don't know how to do it. We don't see any way to do it, and so therefore it will never be done.
But the truth of the matter seems to be emerging now, Tom, that somebody has figured out how to do it.
That's correct. Nikola Tesla was the first one, as far as I can find out, who found out how to do that. Tesla found out how to make a more fundamental electromagnetic wave. Without saying it in these words, what he did was he found out that if he turned the waves against themselves, locked them together so that they summed to zero, their fields summed to zero, that he could make a more fundamental wave, a more fundamental vibration, that would do extraordinary things. He reported that he could produce energy at a distance or transmit it at a distance without wires and without any losses, or very little losses indeed. He didn't report that he could extract energy from a distance the same way, but he did report that he could build a big eye that could see at a distance, and that would have been the way he would have been doing that.
So we're looking at the science of Nikola Tesla, which has been refined, and perhaps, Tom, is being used against us and what we're looking upon as the weather war.
That's correct.
The subject tonight of Open Mind, my guest is Tom Bearden. I'm Bill Jenkins. Bill Jenkins, it's Open Mind. With me is Tom Bearden, who has electrified us on many occasions, but tonight it's something important. Well, it always is. But it is that we are in the midst, perhaps, of the first battles of the weather war. And the weapon is something you're describing called a scalar wave. Is that not right?
That's correct. Let me explain what a scalar wave is. First of all, it's a gravitational wave. And I'm going to explain real simply how to make it. And then I'll give you a very concrete way of seeing that the energy really is there and you really are making a curvature of space-time or a gravitational wave. Imagine you have a plate in front of you, a steel plate. And you have your fingers pressing on each side of the plate. The two hands are pressing on the plate with the fingers extended so that the fingers are a series of forces pressing on that plate. But there are equal and opposite forces on it, and so the plate is under equal pressure in all directions. In other words, equal set of forces. They all sum to zero. We say they have a zero resultant. That means the plate does not accelerate, doesn't move, doesn't wiggle, doesn't jiggle. It would seem to just be sitting there and doing nothing. But that's a very different plate indeed from one which has no forces at all on it. That plate is under stress. Now suppose I rhythmically increase the pressure with which I'm pushing and decrease it. I increase it and decrease it in rhythmic fashion. The plate now is being stressed and relieved, stressed and relieved. And so there is a stress wave in the plate, but the plate still does not wiggle, does not jiggle, does not move, does not accelerate. Now, give us any indication of that unless something breaks, unless it fractures. And that plate has a stress wave, and it is the medium. Now, if we throw the plate away and we have the vacuum in front of us, pure space-time, and we have electromagnetic forces acting against each other and locked together, we have exactly the same situation existing in the vacuum. We have stress in the vacuum itself that we've placed in there with this wave that sums to zero. All the fields sum to zero vectors. And now if we rhythmically vary all the components, all the individual little fingers of forces stressing the vacuum, we will increase the stress and decrease it, increase it and decrease it. And so we will produce in the vacuum a stress wave. However, look at it this way. There is no resultant force field being created there at the place we're stressing it. Yet the energy from every one of those forces, which now are waves, is locked in at that point. And so we have at that point increase in the energy and decrease in the energy that's locked in vacuum. And rigorously, by general relativity, that constitutes a gravitational wave. In other words, a scalar wave, a scalar electromagnetic wave, is really an electrogravitational wave. It is the final solution to the electrogravitics that started with such promise and then died out in the early 60s in the United States and some in Europe. But it is an electrogravitational wave. And what you have done is you have turned electrical energy, electromagnetic energy, directing into gravitational field energy, and vice versa. So with this tool now, you have a new kind of electromagnetic wave, and it bridges the difference between electromagnetism and gravitation. Now, I know that these tapes are played many places, and I know we have many technical people listening to us in the audience. If, bear with me for just a moment. If you will check the Colusa paper that in the 1921 was published upon the recommendation of Albert Einstein, you will find that Colusa, for example, had unified gravitational field theory and electromagnetic field theory. He did this by adding another dimension so that you had a five-dimensional science. Now, don't get worried about dimensions. They're just very fundamental variables. We're talking about how a mathematical model is built here, that's all. But when you did that, you only had one kind of field in this so-called higher universe. And our universe intersects that field in two fashions. It intersects it in one fashion as our normal gravitational field, and the rest of it bleeds out in the fifth dimension there as what we see as electromagnetic field. Now, it turns out that it's a great deal easier for that five-dimensional gravitational field to bleed into electromagnetics. So all you technical people, please sit up and write this down in your textbook or in your little notebook. Anytime you have a circuit or a series of circuits which allows the free travel of ordinary electromagnetic force fields, you have a circuit which continually bleeds off the fundamental five-dimensional gravitational field. And therefore, you're not going to get any bleed-off into the ordinary gravitational field to speak of. You'll get very little gravitational effects, if any. So small, you can't even measure them. On the other hand, if you choke off the throttle, so to speak, you choke off the valve, allowing the bleed off of this field into electromagnetics, and you do that by fighting electromagnetics against itself, making vector zeros. When you shut off the main pipeline, but you still have little pipelines through the shut-off valve so that you can pump this more fundamental field that Colusa talked about, then that pumping has to go into the ordinary gravitational field. In other words, what I've shown you by a little analogy here is that you indeed are turning electromagnetic energy directly into gravitational field energy and vice versa when you make the vector zeros. Now, that's enough of the technical stuff. Let's talk about now how to use it.
All right, that is what we really want to get into. We did want to set some technical basis for what we're talking about.
Right.
Because the things that we're going to discuss that seem to be happening, that a great deal of data has been gathered so far, we can say with some degree of confidence, because of the data that is here, photographs, other things, that we have come to the point where that very well, that science, may be used against us in what we're calling here tonight, the weather war. Behind and with me, Tom Bearden. Tom, very involved in some of the outer limits of scientific research and understanding, and certainly one of the most knowledgeable men around about a new science known as scalar interferometry. And it is that scalar wave now that is creating a lot of problems. A lot of problems emotionally for a lot of scientists on the western side, and problems for us physically, it looks like, Tom.
Yes, that's true, Bill. And it's the technology, unfortunately, has been being developed for quite a while in the Soviet Union. I would call attention real quickly to some of the background for people who haven't heard these presentations before. In 1960, Khrushchev pointed out that the Soviet Union had a new fantastic weapon, very powerful indeed. In fact, remarks were made that it could destroy all life on Earth if it were unrestrainedly used. The first part of that is, of course, printed in the New York Times in January of 1916, can be checked. So we know that in 1960 they were in advanced research and development for some kind of very, very powerful new weapon, which seemed to be greater than the rockets and missiles and nukes and everything else. In 1963, we have incidents of the Thresher, mysterious death of the Thresher, its loss, and certain circumstances that happened with it. The day after the death of the Thresher, there was another one of these giant mushrooms of water that rose up a half a mile to 3/4 of a mile or so high in this case, about 100 miles from Puerto Rico. That appears to have been the test of one of these weapons that had gone on-site operational. So it seems that about 1963 or so, the weapons actually went on-site operational in the Soviet Union. There is some tentative evidence, which is probably better than I've had time to look at, because I simply have not had time to go through it. But that 1967, they started a first tentative attempt at doing some weather engineering over the United States. The signatures for that weather engineering was mysterious and anomalous holes that appeared in clouds throughout the U.S. It was noted by the meteorologists. They took pictures, for example, recorded the incidents, and printed them in the journals and technical magazines. They're there for 1967. And, of course, in 67-68, we had a very severe winter, which may have been the result of early-on weather engineering by the Soviet Union. If so, I do not know the nature of the transmitters, have not had time to look in to see if that can be found. So maybe some other researchers would look at 67-68 real good, and those anomalous holes and any possible connection with the weather conditions, freak weather conditions that happened in 67-68. But certainly before the death of Brezhnev, let's say about towards the end of 82, the Soviet Union began to adjust in the interference of gigantic beams over the United States. Now, let me backtrack just a moment. In the mid-70s, the world was shocked by the advent of very powerful transmitters from the Soviet Union in the communications band, down in the megahertz region there, 3 to 30 megahertz, where the normal communications are chattering away all the time. And they were interfering with communications worldwide. These were called the woodpecker signals because the chirp signal sounded very much like a woodpecker's beak hitting a wooden block. And so in the mid-70s, they did open up very, very powerful transmitters of the normal kind. Now, I'm not particularly interested in the normal electromagnetic force fields that we normally measure on those signals. Now, that's the normal stuff, and everybody out there, all our scientists, has plenty of good instrumentation to measure that to a gnat's eyebrow. I'm interested, however, in the hidden scalar stuff that is riding on those signals. And I can tell you there is some there that a friend of mine named Frank Golden has measured scalar signals connected with the Soviet weather engineering.
So we have powerful transmissions coming into the United States.
That's right. Very powerful indeed. Estimates of the power of those things run up to, oh goodness gracious, 100 megawatts.
Well, that's very, very powerful.
Very powerful transmitters indeed. And they do interfere with communications. Several nations of the world have protested repeatedly to the Soviet Union. It's always been ignored. And they're chattering away out there still most every night with these transmitters. Now,
We have a series of transmitters now that are beginning to, or that are, it looks like, or it is your contention.
Yes.
Creating a great problem, which we want to get back into, Tom, for just a second. You're listening to Open Mind tonight. My guest is Tom Bearden, and we're talking about the weather war. And our guest, Tom Bearden, says it's underway, and we happen to be on the receiving end of it. Tom, we were getting into the broadcast of woodpecker signals, but more important to you was the scalar stuff that is also being broadcast along with. In what way is that a problem for us?
Okay, if you'll check, for example, if we look at the latest publication for the general public by the DOD, by the Defense Department, called Soviet Military Power, page 45 of that shows the intersection over the United States of the giant beams from the Soviet woodpecker radars. We say that they are, in fact, over-the-horizon ballistic missile detection systems, which indeed they are. They can do that job, too. And again, I'm not particularly interested in that, except, you know, for ballistic missile early warning. They, however, can do much more than that with the scalar components that are placed on them. And our scientists do not have instruments that pick up and detect the scalar modulations on the radar. The scalar signals are not detected. So if we look at the pattern of the beams, however, we find that they form an intersection directly over the U.S. After all, if you're going to look for U.S. missile launches, that's exactly what you'd want to do. But if you have a nice intersection already over the United States, wouldn't it be nice if you could do something with that, with the scalar stuff? Because now you have a scalar interferometer that intersects over the United States. And indeed you can. For example, if you make two scalar electromagnetic beams and you interfere them, cross them at a distance, in that crossed point, you can do two things real easy. If the potential you're transmitting with is high, in other words, the voltage is high where you're transmitting, energy will emerge in that distant cross point, in that distant zone. It will emerge throughout that zone. But it is not traveling from the transmitter out there as energy in the normal sense. It's just a potential wave. So you put energy in at the transmitters, you get energy out in the zone out there. If you pulse powerful transmitters like that, so the pulses meet out there, what you get is a sudden violent emergence of energy, and you get something like an electromagnetic explosion. That's the things like the high altitude booms that went off the east coast of the U.S. a few years ago. They were just calibrating the use of these kinds of scalar interferometers or howitzers in that mode. The second thing you can do with this kind of scalar interferometer, if you lower the voltage negative, very negative, on the transmitter and transmit in that mode, you do a very strange thing. The energy flow works in reverse. You extract energy now from the distant zone where the beams cross, and the energy that's extracted there emerges back at the transmitters, again, without traveling through space between as normal electromagnetic energy. It just traveled as a potential wave, a curve of space-time. And so then you have to do something with the energy if you extract very much, or it'll burn out your transmitters. If you are going to do that on a pretty large scale, you're going to be extracting lots of energy from various places in the world, and you'll burn out your transmitters unless you dump it somewhere. Well, what you do, you catch the energy and hold it temporarily for just a moment, and switch into the transmit mode and transmit it to a preordained dump site where it's just exhausted in the atmosphere. And our weather satellites have taken, since 1973, over 100 photographs of just such exhausts emerging from Bennett Island, the Soviet Union's Bennett Island. For example, one of those exhausts alone is 150 miles long, and it's almost horizontal on the ground. It's about a degree and a half above the horizontal. Now, I submit to you that volcanoes don't do that. They don't blast away almost horizontally for 150 miles. In streams, a stream of stuff coming out in the jet for 150 miles long. Our weather satellites have photographed that. And, for example, in this videotape we've made, we've included that photograph. They have photographed the emergence of explosive pulses, puffs of exhaust, when transmissions are made, the energy arrived explosively. And so Bennett Island is the smoking gun, so to speak, or the evidence for it. It is the evidence of the exhaust site for the weapons I'm talking about, and there are over 100 satellite photos showing just that.
So we have a situation where scalar beams are being crossed over the United States. When they connect with each other, energy is either dumped in that area, which would create a high-pressure zone, or it is extracted from that area, which would create a low-pressure zone.
That's correct.
And that's all of the ingredients you need for a weather war. Jenkins, Open Mind is the name of this program, and you need one to learn some things you certainly should be considering. Our guest is Thomas E. Bearden. Tom, one of the leading theoretical physicist in the nation today. He's been deeply involved in the development of some of our weapon systems, is out on the outer edge of physics and science. I appreciate him being with us because he is able to put some very complicated technical material in language that we all can understand. I realize this first 50 minutes has been rather complex, and I applaud you, Tom, and how simple you have made it sound. I have some people here listening, and they're understanding what you're saying.
Good. That's the intent.
We have, then, these new form of electromagnetic waves that are crisscrossing the United States, coming together, forming a grid, and at that point, energy can be dumped into that interference zone or extracted. That can create highs and lows and certainly do other damage. Is this what was used, in your opinion, off the coast of South Africa when we detected huge blast out there and thought the South Africans had an atomic bomb?
Yes, indeed. For example, as I said, if you are firing in the energy merge mode, if you fire in that mode pulses, so the pulses meet, you have an explosive eruption of energy at the point where they cross. And when you do that, you'll get an electromagnetic explosion. You'll have energy given off, and it will look very much like a nuclear explosion if you really pulse it real hard with a lot of energy. For example, you'll have the same rise time that you do with the initial pulse of the nuclear explosion. When the energy is absorbed suddenly in the superheated and compressed air layer around it, you will have a sudden absorption of it, so you'll have the pulse drop off. Then as that layer re-emits the energy at a little bit lower temperature, you'll have a second pulse. It'll look very similar to the two pulses you get out of a nuclear explosion. The difference will be that the pulses will be a little bit more gradual in their decay time and won't be quite the same, because in a nuclear explosion you have the heavier material around the bomb, and so you have more matter to absorb the thing. In the emergence of the electromagnetic explosion, you only have the air and so forth around it, and so you'll have a difference in the absorber material that absorbs the first pulse and then re-radiates it as the second pulse, and that'll give you some difference in the two pulses, and that's the distinction. And that's exactly what the Vela saw, by the way. It saw that kind of a double pulse, which had the kind of difference with the pulses from a nuclear explosion that you would expect if it was electromagnetic energy emerging and air being the absorber. So yes, the Vela satellites detected, I believe, an electromagnetic explosion caused by this kind of a weapon as a test.
And that sort of is borne out by some other facts about that blast. Number one, there was no radiation ever detected, and that was the prime purpose of the Vela satellite. So there was a huge dump of energy with no radiation detected. And didn't it happen a couple of weeks later in the infrared spectrum?
Well, some months later it happened. Another blast was detected by the satellites, and this one was detected in the infrared. So that wouldn't be a nuke at all, because nukes don't go just in the infrared, and not any kind of nuclear explosion we know anything about. So that would rule out nuclear explosions, but it would not rule out the electromagnetic explosion, because depending on the type of wave you interfered, you could rig it so you would get that.
All right. Now, if we have a way of artificially creating a massive high-pressure zone, would you be able to create one high enough or strong enough to bend the jet streams?
Yes, indeed, because one of the anomalous kinds of things that's been going on to divert the jet stream is already reported by the meteorologists. They're very puzzled over the mechanisms they're calling blocking mechanisms. In other words, gigantic highs, high-pressure areas, that don't move along like they normally do in the atmosphere. They just suddenly sit there. And whereas normally in 3 to 7 days or so you can expect those kinds of things to change and the weather change, in the blocking mechanisms that have been evidenced in the last decade or so, you've had anomalous blocking where high-pressure areas arise anomalously and sit there. And they can sit there for, you know, weeks at a time. And when you do this, you can divert the jet streams and everything else, because the stream is just a giant stream of air. And if there's a high-pressure area in its way, it'll divert around the high-pressure area.
Is that what we saw in 1983 when a very, very strange thing happened? The jet streams, which usually course from west to east across the northern part of the United States, suddenly were diverted very gently down to where they turned around Washington and Oregon, went south down into Texas, and then up the Adirondack Chain.
Well, as a matter of fact, in December of 83, it's already recorded by the meteorologist that we had anomalous high-pressure blocking. There was a high-pressure area, I believe, and I don't have my notes here, so I'm going off the top of my head, but I believe there was one off over the Rockies and one over the North Atlantic at that time. And the blocking mechanisms, by the way, is very controversial still with the meteorologists. They simply do not understand what's going on and what's causing it. And a good meteorologist will tell you they don't understand it. Yes, indeed. In December of 83, certainly, we had anomalous high-pressure blocking areas, and we've had them several times before.
Well, what was interesting about that curvature of the jet stream that happened then is that that stopped the warm, moist air from the Gulf of Mexico from moving up into the midsection of the United States, and we lost half of our corn crop.
Well, that whole year was very anomalous. As I said, beginning before the death of Brezhnev and continuing thereafter, they were adjusting this grid, the scalar components of the grid, by moving the beam slightly and moving the scalar components around. When you do that, you slip, the energy slips out a little bit, pops out, and you get mysterious rumbles and booms and snaps and crackles and pops. You get airquakes, for example. Sometimes you get very anomalous little micro quakes in the earth in a very localized area. And so throughout the United States during that period, we were getting these snaps and crackles and pops almost everywhere. We were getting them down off the coast of Florida and over Alabama, up through the eastern states in the middle of the country and off over California and so forth, and up in the northwest as well. They were reported all over the United States, the anomalous airquakes and microquakes, mostly the airquakes for those. And so, yes, the evidence of adjusting the grid was there.